Chapter 2 West Interviews. Spring was just around the corner, and the trees were already seeing buds forming. It would not be long before John was complaining about the lawn work that needed tending. The girls had already placed their order, and the grill sizzled in response to the cuts of marinated beef that now occupied the grate. The music that should be playing in the background was constantly being interrupted by his daughter's incessant need to upstage the other with the latest in a never-ending series of slightly humorous short video clips. Chandra paused the interview on the screen. Looking back over her shoulder, she criticized what she had seen. "The grill sizzled? How do you know what the grill sounded like, Grandpa?" This generated a sour look and a quick glance in her direction. "Who do you think was running the grill? Wes bought the meat, and I did the cooking. I dished up 3 plates for them and 2 for Mother and me. Now stop interrupting my program." Satisfied, Chandra returned to the computer screen and clicked play. "So, Dad," Sarah began, "when are you making the first attempt?" She was referring to the first test of the new step drive testbed that was under construction. "Should be sometime next week if everything goes as planned," John said as he popped into the house and closed the screen behind him. The swirling breeze on the deck caused the aroma of the barbecue to drift into the room, reminding both girls that it was their job to set the table. It happened immediately. "And you plan on being the first to test it out?" Rachel asked with a hint of defiance. Reaching into the refrigerator, John extracted the plate containing the jumbo shrimp that rested on skewers. With a questioning look, he said, "Not the first test. You know the schedule." "But you still plan on being the pilot?" she queried. "That's the plan," he said, making his way to the screen door. As his fingers settled on the handle, he turned back to her and asked, "Why?"
"Just asking," she said in a nonchalant voice.
After the meat got turned, the shrimp soon joined the fray, and the questions that drifted back inside was, "Why is there no music playing?" But the girls were too busy scrounging the net for the next clip to give credence to such trifles. The meal complete, and a well-timed phone call, saw the girls bounding towards the front door, leaving John to languish in his recliner. Alone. Dying. "I'm never doing that to myself again," he thought about the second, twice-stuffed potato and the mistake of eating the whole thing. Then, wondering how the girls went back for thirds, remembered the earlier conversation. "Rachel seems perturbed about something," John's thought flowed. "There's no one else I can ask to make the first flight. If it all goes wrong, it needs to be me who suffers the consequences." His mind began to drift off to a comfortable place, and his eyes were getting heavy. Next week already. As his mind slipped into blackness, he thought about the new drive and what it would mean to physics, in general, if it worked. At this point, it was not hard to invoke Nikola Tesla's name, because his genius was instrumental in the step drive's construction. But then to think back on the era in which he lived and not be astonished by all the great minds that arose during that period. Electricity was being tamed. The laws of thermodynamics was being utilized. Light was understood to be a particle. No, wait. It's a wave. Supercold temperatures were being reached. The atom itself was being expressed in terms that physicists could work with. Space, time, gravity were reformulated. It was as though the planet were tootling along one day, minding its own business, and then suddenly it hit a pothole in knowledge that got all over everything. It did not take long for a bunch of smart people to build off that knowledge, and build they did. Some avenues were successful, while others have turned into box canyons with no way out but to go back. To some, that thought is unimaginable, so yeah, keep going. See you on the other side. A smile crept onto John's lips as he drifted off to sleep. Tesla's genius was his pioneering work in electrical tension, harmonics, and resonance. When combined correctly with the plasma sheath,
it becomes possible to step onto the gravity plane. At least, that is the easiest way John found to describe it. Like the layered electromagnetic effect of the Birkeland currents, this plane is constructed of layered tension forces. By stepping through these layers, different force levels are encountered. But with each step comes a significant expenditure of power to get you there and hold you. However, if you achieve a stable step, then any momentum change produces an angle of reflection. The greater the reflection, the longer the baseline once you return to normal space. Direction of travel is governed by the internal magnetic field of the plasmoid itself. For the first engines developed around this concept, it was required to keep away from strong magnetic fields during the step to ensure no abnormal rotation of the toroidal magnetic field was exerted. So being close to Earth was a bad idea, as the expected direction of travel was not reliable. Mars seemed like a good place to set up shop for several reasons. Mars's magnetic field is essentially non-existent, and any accidents that might occur could not harm the Earth, and for John, that was essential. John's biggest problem was that everything to this point was still a secret, but that was about to change. The kids heard the commercial break at the same time, but Dottie got the first question in.
Gramps, who helped John build the fast ship with the step thing?
Leaning back, he looked over at the three youths, who obviously all had questions. The slight sigh went unnoticed. Well, let's see. Shannon Beale was there as his system engineer. Vlad Bierke did the electronic design. Trevor Noah did a lot of the mechanical and design and construction. Then there was Miguel Delanoy and Ann Berg. I think they were both on the payroll as system techs.
That would have been awesome to see it come together,
Darius speculated.
Perhaps the one thing that brought the whole project together in record time was the fact that not a single person understood what the hell was really going to happen. The team members had just enough information to modify the skiff, then build and mount the control gear, but the step drive was John's department alone.
The three sets of eyeballs refused to blink as he listened intently.
John understood what the math behind his theory told him would happen when the power was applied, and he knew how to project a thrust vector. Basically, you were either on step and it's working, or you're in normal space. He was the only one with a true grasp of the science behind the drive, and for now, he would keep it that way.
I thought his core group did most of that work, Chandra interjected.
His core team had helped with creating the plasmoid generator, but the coil design to compress the central plasmoid structure and get it to resonate with the gravity plane was left up to John to complete. This freed them up to design the advanced power system that John knew would be needed if he genuinely wanted the drive to function over a long distance.
What's a plasmoid generator?
Dottie demanded.
You can find all that stuff in the archive, but a plasmoid is a self-sustaining bit of plasma. Just look up ball lightning sometime. So the generator creates this plasma ball that surrounds a ship, and the magnetic outriggers are there to control the shape of the plasmoid. With the step drive's assistance, it causes the inner torus of the plasmoid to resonate with the gravity plane and hold it. That is how the ship gets on step.
The end to the commercial break signaled an end to the discussion.
Now, my program's coming back on, so do your own homework.
The kids returned to the screen in front of them. Gramps looked back at the television, but his vision blurred. The quick explanation to the children was a bluff, because in reality, he did remember the explanation given to the core group of electrical engineers regarding John's theory of the gravity plane, a speech that John had perfected, using him as the sounding board, resulting in the meeting that set the whole plan in motion.
Look, guys,
Gramps' mind drifted back over the decades as John began his talk to the five people gathered around the table. Einstein was a smart guy. No argument there. But his theories put a limit on information. It can't travel faster than light. If you study the problem long enough, you realize that if Earth only knows where the sun was 8 minutes ago, which is how long it takes light to get to the Earth from the sun, then the Earth would be moving along the wrong path to maintain a stable orbit around the sun. Remember, John said with conviction, both the sun and Earth are hauling ass through space, and in 8 minutes, both have moved a long distance. Without the proper influence applied, the Earth would have spun off into the void a long time ago. So the correction to the interacting bodies must be getting updated faster than that. Something fundamental is missing. Gramps remembered looking at the faces of his tiny audience. This begs the question, John continued. Just how fast does the influence of gravity travel? The reason Newton's law of gravity works is because there is no time variable involved. Time does not exist in the equation. Gravity is assumed to be instantaneous between the two bodies. Gramps glanced back over at the children, who by now were searching the internet for more information to what Gramps was unwilling to provide. His thoughts flowed back to that nearly forgotten discussion as his program played on. The Corps was fully aware of the success of their plasma thrust unit and the importance electricity played in all aspects of life. Now John hoped to use their knowledge and experience to help develop a new area of physics based on the very same interplay of electromagnetism and plasma by introducing gravity. You guys have all heard of ball lightning and how it accompanies storms, volcanoes, and even earthquakes. The nodding heads helped John formulate his next thoughts. Well, it's the plasmoid that is self-sustaining, at least for a time. Then it changes and either disappears or explodes. Again, he appeared encouraged by the group's acknowledgement. These plasmoids are able to move through solid objects, even burn their way through without collapsing. Not in all cases, but in a variety that have been witnessed. My hunch is that these plasmoids can interact with something that is beyond our sense of reality. I'm betting they are interacting with what I call the electrically tensioned vacuum energy. It's what we all refer to as gravity. What? Came a sarcastic response from one of the engineers. What the hell does that mean? Gramps remembered the same level of confusion on all the faces. Okay, how about I use the terminology that makes the most sense to me? John spoke softly, not wanting to lose their attention. I speak of the gravity force as an electrically constrained history of synchronized interactions. The look of confusion continued. Yeah, that doesn't help much, John, Joseph Zench said, slowly shaking his head. Electrically tensioned and electrically constrained sound an awful lot alike. It's meant to, John spoke cautiously. Let me expand on my thought just a bit. He stood, then taking the dry erase pen in his hand, began a series of drawings. If particles of energy share a history by interaction, then no matter the distance they are separated, that history will still exist. Do you agree with that statement? John asked, pointing to the relationship he had just drawn. Receiving an acknowledgement, he continued. It's because of the shared history written into the past and the future that they are constrained. They become constrained by an electrical tension that falls off by the square of the distance between. But the history, that connection, remains. It is the tension that drops off, even though the two particles remain constrained. That is how the polarized photon can affect the entangled twin, no matter the distance. By altering the history of the one, you effectively alter the history of the second, because of the electrical constraint that the two items shared in the past. He emphasized his point. Okay, I guess. Joseph's voice was far from serious. But you seem to be saying that there is a connection, a physical connection between the two that keeps going. What is that? He wasn't the only person present who wanted that question answered. Everyone here has heard of vacuum energy, I'm assuming. The expectant faces showed that they had. Well, in quantum physics, each point in space is looked at as a quantum harmonic oscillator that responds to energy. Gramps could see the faces in his memory. These guys were not physicists. They were electrical engineers who occasionally read articles that covered other branches of science. He knew that John was about to take that first step into the rabbit hole that his audience was unfamiliar with. John continued, "My presumption is that these tiny oscillators are always in motion, continuously transitioning between states when not affected by external energy sources." He stopped for a moment so his audience did not miss his next leap of faith. The oscillators are randomly transitioning between the past and the future, with matter providing the framework for what we perceive as the present. The expressions confirmed that they had not missed his point. Again, he continued. Then, the electrical nature of matter causes these quantum fluctuations to rotate, spending less time in the past and the future, and more time oscillating in the present. As this rotation occurs, the oscillations align and synchronize around the matter that they sense. Here he paused. The silence became uncomfortable. Finally, "Now these fluctuations are synchronizing. Why would they do that?" demanded one of the many skeptics. John was back at the whiteboard drawing a sketch of a platform suspended by four ropes. Anchored to the platform were several pendulums meant to be swinging at unique points. He continued his talk. "Oscillators will synchronize with each other the way pendulums and metronomes will synchronize if they are physically connected by a free-floating structure, even at a distance. They just have to share a connection, and that connection is the dipole effect of the alignment of these oscillators." "Not really," came a terse response. "No, he's right about that," Joseph interjected. "We did that experiment in high school with six metronomes. It takes a while, but eventually they'll all synchronize, as long as the length of the pendulums are the same." He was beginning to recognize the direction John was leading the group. John stood there looking over the varied expressions. He could tell he had not hit the mark, but he needed to push on. "If these oscillations exist," John posited, "and if they can affect one another, and if nearby matter can provide a local background on which to synchronize to one another, then the synchronization will reach out farther and farther." Again, he paused in case any of them needed vent. After a moment, he continued. "Now, add in a second, distant piece of matter experiencing the same phenomenon. When the two unique sets of synchronized oscillations of the vacuum energy meet for the first time, they begin to interact and synchronize between the two pieces of matter, forming a straight path of synchronized oscillations of electrical potential." Both John and Gramps could tell this last statement, introducing the electrical component back into the discussion, helped. Several nods were detected. "But remember," John advanced, "this path is already being established by the loss of these random fluctuations into the future, so that when the connection occurs, it's instantaneous. The history has been written in the future, and the corresponding results is an electrical connection that creates this tensioning between the objects." "John, you really are reaching," Joseph opined. Not really, John said with confidence. Matter is energy. The vacuum energy sees this matter and aligns itself to it, like a dipole. Well, dipoles near one another like to align themselves, and if the vacuum energy stops fluctuating randomly and aligns itself between two pieces of matter, then an electrical force will form. With this synchronized alignment of fluctuating energy, I'm assuming that you essentially get a form of Birkeland current that is the emergent property. That, in effect, is how the electrical tensioning manifests itself. It is far weaker than an electrostatic force, but the effect is there, like a taut wire stretched between the two objects. John, I think we would have discovered that kind of effect by now, another engineer argued. And how does something like that not become obvious on a large scale? Actually, it is the large scale where it becomes most apparent. I reference the huge plasma current filaments that traverse interstellar and intergalactic space. These filaments twist together to form Birkeland currents, and even cosmologists recognize that star formations occur along these plasma filaments. They just don't buy into the idea of the electric force being much of a contributor to the universe structure, even though the electrical effect far outperforms the gravity effect. John emphasized, then added, "Why do you think the astrophysicists had to develop dark matter?" "It is because gravity does not behave the way they expect it to when they look to larger and larger scales. So you either modify the existing gravity equations to somehow fit the data, or you invent a new form of matter that you cannot see, but which makes up 20% of the universe. If you're going to stick with Einstein's interpretation of gravity and his information speed limit, then that is your only choice." "But wouldn't these connections of yours reveal themselves like a reformulated ether or something? And wasn't that quite the failed theory?" another member asked sarcastically. "Not if you can't see them." "Okay, I give up. Why can't you see them?" the woman asked. "Because the connections only manifest in the vacuum energy. More precisely, the future sees these dipole alignments altering their view of gravity, while the past sees the same kind of dipole alignment establishing an unalterable layered history of events. And there is no way to probe this scale. Not yet, anyway." Yeah. "Why are we here again?" Joseph asked, trying to clear his head. "Because I want to try and latch onto this series of connections and hold myself there." In the past? "If you like," John pressed on. "I see these connections as being shaped by Birkeland currents. Layer upon layer of these tensioned histories that are being built up over time. If you can latch onto one of these layers, then provide a thrust vector, you begin to move along the layer. When you release your grip, you reflect into normal space. By adding momentum with thrust while latched onto the connection, you have moved the angle of incident from your starting point in normal space along the tensioned gravity lines. Release your grip and the reflection back to normal space mirrors that." "No pun intended," John said with a smile. "None taken," Joseph said offhandedly. "And you want to try to grab hold of this connection how exactly?" "That's where the plasmoid comes in. We create a plasmoid, use a set of magnetic coils to compress the center of the toroid while imparting a harmonic resonance with the connection and hopefully create a bond with it." "Sorry I asked," Joseph said with a half smile. "And you think that whatever is inside the plasmoid once the connection is made will also be latched to this connection of yours in the past? Electrically constrained history, but yes. John's voice remained confident. "What I'm trying to do here is prove whether my idea has merit," John emphasized. "If we can create a sympathetic connection of a toroidal sheath to whatever you want to call it, let's call it the electrically tensioned gravity plane, then it may be possible to make use of this gravity plane. That's all I'm saying. And that's what I want to hire you guys to help me test." Gramps remembered the other four engineers looking around at one another, unsure how to react. John pushed forward. "If there was ever a scientist who glimpsed what I am trying to do here, it was Tesla. Some of the experiments he performed, and was later testified to by members of his audience, indicate, to me, that he had successfully created these harmonic connections, and was able to manipulate them. I just don't think he understood what his resonant device was coupling to." Gramps returned to the present, heard the discussion over the background noise of the television, as Dottie insisted that they stop looking at lightning stuff and get back to the archive. This caused him a single moment of levity before he realized the show he had been watching, his favorite show on TV, had just finished the first quarter of an hour without his attention, and it had just gone back to a commercial break. West interviews. Thinking back to the early days of the drive, John couldn't help but see the group doing their work and getting in each other's way. Shannon had designed the enhanced life support for the craft out of parts on hand, and what they didn't have available got purchased on Earth and shipped up. Both Shannon and Vlad mounted and tested the new hydrogen plasma thrust unit, which propels the craft, along with updating the fuel cell to provide the needed power for the thrust unit and to charge the power bank for the step drive. Trevor, Anne, and Miguel modified the craft to accommodate the new components and then did final hookup, inspection, and checkout, which involved removing the outer cargo crumple layer from the main pressure vessel and fabricating a new skin that would not only fit the drive's elongated plasma generator, but support the magnetic compression outriggers. These compression coils were necessary to produce the harmonic plasma shell that would envelop the entire craft and force the generated plasmoid's central core to compress and interact with the electrically tensioned gravity plane. When complete, Vlad's comment seemed appropriate. "It's a Picasso," he said admiringly. "It certainly costs as much," was all John could muster. The thought of money brought a flood of concern into his mind. His creditors, his masters, were wanting real monetary results from the installation, and so far, he was not to the point of profit, and they were not shy about reminding him of that either. This fact, combined with the shockingly little progress of the experimental helium-3 refining process that the financiers backed, coalesced into a brooding group of investors with a direct line of communication to him. Like the helium-3, there were several projects taking place that Western Wave had nothing to do with, other than transportation and housing, but that didn't stop the criticisms from being laid at John's doorstep. The following day was checkout. Using the tiny ship's plasma drive, they moved it and a second skiff about 300 kilometers away from the moon's surface and performed a series of checks prior to the first attempt to go to step. Once the capacitor banks got charged and fired, the sharp energy spike created the plasma sheath. The batteries were there to supply the power needed by the harmonic compression coils to maintain the sheath at a shape and resonance that coupled with the layers of the tensioned gravity. 20 seconds later, the batteries were drained and the drive power down. These first experiments were controlled by the onboard computer because no one would be in the craft during these first tests. A locator beacon was running the whole time to ensure that if the skiff did move, it could be found again. This continuous signal was detected by the camp's emergency service, who started calling around to find out what the problem was. "Just running some tests, nothing to get alarmed about," John cringed as he spoke. The call came back. "Keep us in the loop, Skiff 9. Harbor out." and so it began. Each series started with the plasma sheath suddenly surrounding the craft. Then, as the coils compressed and adjusted the resonance of the system, the glow of the plasma began to shimmer, then fade. The glow never faded away entirely, but remained a ghostly, soft white cloud that began to drift around in all directions, sometimes moving just a few meters, other times disappearing entirely in a streak, but always reappearing an instant later to begin oscillating in a new direction. The phenomenon was not understood, but Miguel's guess was the randomness of the magnetic field. Sure, why not? Everyone thought. After a predetermined amount of time, with the batteries depleted, the skiff would pop back into existence near to where it had been at the start of the test. With the data collected and the ship deemed okay, it was piloted back to Camp 2, and an inspection of the components in the craft were underway. The three children were enthralled by the interview on the screen in front of them. Suddenly, they heard the question that each wanted to ask. Was it a success? A question that produced a surprising fact. The team was excited by the progress of that first day, and it seemed like the theory had legs. The skiff was intact, and everything else involved with the test appeared to be in good shape. John insisted on being the pilot for that first set of reflection tests scheduled for the next day, because if something went wrong, there was no backup plan for rescue, unless the ship was close to the moon. The skiff had a radio and beacon, so getting lost was not the problem. More the uncertainty of it all. Everyone was apprehensive. And though it was never noticed, later that day, the two missing chickens reappeared at their usual roosting place, back at the harbor, alarmed, but no worse aware. Moon Archives. The construction of Weiss Harbor had seen the vast amount of rubble from the two tunnels and the resurfacing of the walls and ceiling become the filler for the 80-foot diameter floor. The debris was crushed to the point that it became firm when compressed, and a stabilizing foam was added to the aggregate. Next, a floor consisting of plastic tile was laid down, and finally, a polymer resin sat on top. Though the roof was a rather ugly, unfinished affair, it was considered a work in progress, but it did support the area lighting that provided a nice, bright environment for all the living and working spaces on the gleaming white floor. Central to the dome was the living quarters and cafeteria, supporting its own inflatable white dome structure that was meant to ensure that the dust and dirt generated by the ongoing construction was kept outside. The space had a rather oversized area for prepping meals, along with a serving area that was buffet-style. The seating was nothing more than fold-out plastic tables and stackable plastic chairs. Arriving back at the harbor, John West was pleased to see a selection of Italian delicacies awaiting his approval. Soon after his little group had loaded up their plates, everyone was surprised to see Sarah and Rachel join them. "Girls, I didn't know you were here." Their father's broad grin was combined with cheerful greetings from everyone else. A recap from Anne brought the two up to speed regarding the day's success. Studying her father with a look of contention, Rachel piped up. "We heard you're going to kill yourself tomorrow, and I was wondering if we get the moon base after you're gone." A soft flood of laughter rolled around the table. "Shut up, Rachel," Sarah growled. "You're not supposed to talk about it." "Sorry," Rachel reddened a bit, but she could see the smile had not left her dad's face. "Talk about what?" asked John. "The test tomorrow," Rachel said with an air of doubt. Lad spoke up. "It's going to work," he said with a smile, followed by a thumbs up. "Dad," Sarah said in a near whisper, "Rachel and I have been talking, and I think you should let me be the pilot." Her eyes gave away the fact that the sentence that she had been practicing had not come out as planned. "Sarah," John's accusing reply was not much better. She pushed on. "Dad, you know I'm qualified to fly the skiff. All you're going to do is align the platform and hit go. It's not rocket science." That brought on another round of laughter, but her expression had not changed. Rachel piped up. Dad, she really does want to do this. We've been talking about it now for days. She actually really wants to do this. Sarah chimed in with, And if something happens to you, no one else here knows how to build another step drive. Am I right?
Nobody stirred. On that account, she was right. John was the only person who understood what he had built, and he had done it in secret. The interface equipment was designed by the team based on specs that were submitted to them, and now the mad scientist and his experiment were going to disappear together, hopefully to reappear soon after, but it was murky water they were peering into. Shannon was quick to follow on with her opinion.
John, none of us here want you to make that first flight. I, for one, think it's reckless and a bit selfish.
A series of nods and sheepish looks from around the table brought John out of his pleasant state into one of confusion.
What the hell are you talking about? He stammered. You guys think I'm going to let, of all people, my daughter climb into that thing without knowing what's going to happen first? Screw that!
The table went silent for a time as everyone collected their thoughts. The one thing that was not seen very often was John getting upset, and right now, everyone knew that he was. Rachel was the first to speak.
Okay, how about someone who's qualified to operate an advanced propulsion system?
Like who? John spat out.
Call Santa Claus. He's probably available.
Rachel's sarcasm stung, but she was not finished.
Imagine if the guys at Weiss were to find out about your plan. What do you think they would say? Dad, the point is it can't be you.
Anne, who had sat mute so far, decided it was time to speak her mind. She and Sarah had met at a state fair concert several years before and had become best friends. It was Sarah who had gotten her the job working with the Moon Settlement and, over time, had become like family. So John knew when to disregard anything she had to say. But this time, it hit home.
John, Anne started, we all understand how you feel, but if you really want this to work, then someone other than you needs to test this hardware out. Sarah's good under pressure. Her training in the medical field has helped with that. She understands the importance of making note of everything for the same reason. And above all, she's someone you can trust, don't you think?
After a long pause, it was time to change the subject. Never letting any kind of issue stand between him and a bowl of spaghetti, John asked, How long are you girls planning on staying? Rachel broke into a rant about how Joel Swenson, the engineer in charge of opening the second recently discovered hollow chamber, had a problem with the roof supports. She had to figure out the cost of revamping the layout so the design team could finalize the look. It sounded like she was going to be around for a while. Rachel had been in charge of finding qualified and reasonably priced contractors to work from Earth, producing models with the limited information available. She also handpicked personnel to fill key positions at the Moon Settlement, who worked with these organizations back on Earth to turn the caverns into usable spaces. This was important because the Hounds, who were John's creditors, wanted paying customers shuttling back and forth as soon as possible. This meant they had to have places to stay and things to do while there. Sarah, on the other hand, simply said,
Well, seeing as how I'm going to be testing out your new drive, who knows how long I'll be around?
Half-grins buried their faces in plates of food. John's only response was, Yeah, we'll see. Two sets of eyes had locked onto each other from across the table. The words had been spoken, though their father was completely oblivious to them. To each of the girls, the meaning was slightly different. Rachel would look upon the utterance and point out to her sister,
Watch, as I wrap him around my little finger. See how easy that was?
Whereas Sarah would sigh, then point out the obvious.
God, Rachel, you're such a noob!
And promptly fold him into a pretzel. And so it was, on the 2nd of April, Sarah became the first person to successfully test out the step drive by making a 37-kilometer shift to normal space without passing through it. Over the next several weeks, enhancements were made to the confinement field and vector software to the point where
Only occasionally would the ship go in a completely unexpected direction. West interviews. The 23-second step, as Sarah came to call it, was the limit to the skiff's performance capabilities. Essentially, her day consisted of power up the plasma reactor and get the fuel cells making power for the battery and capacitor banks, move the skiff to the designated coordinates for the first step, then wait. It takes about 40 minutes for the system to charge up, and as long as the sheath becomes stable right away, Sarah is on step. Then the plasma thruster is engaged to add mass to the plasmoid. This induced mass gets converted to momentum along the magnetic flux lines of the plasmoid, and the skiff moves its position. An ever-increasing angle of incidence is created between the starting point in normal space and the gravity plane. When the field shuts down, the craft is reflected back into normal space. The position is changed by 37 kilometers. "Dad, I can go farther in my car in a day than this thing can," being the first words spoken to her father at the end of day one testing. It was true, but wow, really? John flushed. The relationship John had with his daughters was one of love, respect, and condemnation. However, once she started talking about the experience with Anne, it was apparent she was thrilled. Rachel had kept a vigil throughout that first test, and at one point radioed, "Have you run across any space monkeys who think you're their mother?" Sarah, never one to be upstaged by anything her sister did, radioed back. "The gummy bears, I found them." "Space monkeys," her sister corrected, and followed up with, "I didn't think you'd find them. I put them way down in your pack." Sarah's reply was one of boredom. "I've got nothing to do all day but sit here. Trust me, it didn't take long. But yeah, thanks." 3 more days were dedicated to confirming the performance results from the first outing, and by the end of it, Sarah was ready for a break. Both she and Rachel took the shuttle back to the bridge, where Sarah went off to give a detailed report on the reactor's ability and limitations to John's core design team. Rachel, on the other hand, went to give a status report on the construction progress to the Weiss group. Then it was off to the architectural firm, who were drawing up the final plans for the second cavern. A cavern, which they were led to believe, was somewhere in Utah and had been created by nuclear testing back in the 1950s. The work continued with the next generation test bed and the second step drive unit. The drive was underpowered because of the limited energy available. The core, as John called them, had been upgrading the generator to deliver enough power to run everything. The batteries would be there, but now only for emergencies. The hope was to get this next skiff capable of taking and holding step and still have enough juice left over to run all the instruments, life support, and the thrusters. It would mean a big leap forward if it all came together. Moon Archive. Skiff 10 marked the culmination of the best that John's team and the core group could do in short order. It had been 3.5 months of work, but the next generation testbed was ready to try, and this one was meant to cover some ground. In a matter of speaking. The new drive for the next step, Rachel's pet name, had been built and ready to go for over a month. With the rest of the team busy readying the skiff for the drive and the new power plant, John had time to spend with Skiff 9. In fact, the whole team spent time in step space and was universally agreed to be an exhilarating experience at first. The glow of the sheath forming from the discharging capacitor banks as the step was taken, the hum of the battery bank and the current discharge, holding the skiff on step. John had expected one of his senses to perk up and say, "What was that?" But nothing odd happened. Skiff 9 could not actually reach the step level John had anticipated. The plasmoid never disappeared from normal space. This aberration of light just moved around a lot when fixed in space and shot out of sight the moment the pilot added thrust, but for all intents and purposes, it never faded to black. If John's understanding was correct, the plasmoid existed in both states under this energy level. It was going to be interesting to see how the next drive affected its surroundings. West interviews. Before taking that step into the unknown, Sarah had given the rest of her family a heads up about some work she was about to embark on. There were risks, but it was her job, and she wanted to do it. It was secret, and she couldn't talk about it, etc. Being in the medical field, Deb, her mother, had a dreadful fear it had something to do with a drug-induced near-death experience like Hollywood had portrayed so many times. What Sarah had hoped would be a half-hour conversation turned into a weekend throwdown. To calm her mother's nerves, Sarah invoked her dad's name.
"What?"
Deb stammered.
"You're doing this for your father?"
At this point, Sarah sat her down and told her the whole story, which she believed none of, not at first anyway.
"You mean Rachel knows about this too?"
Deb's mouth was finding it difficult to close because her mind was busy with other things. It took a while, but at some point, Deb accepted what was happening. Her half-hearted blessing, "Well, if that's really what you want to do, I can't stop you, but please be careful," was welcomed like a breath of fresh air. With a sigh of relief, Sarah saw the end in sight regarding this conversation. The only thing left to do was to get her to promise not to tell. "Like anyone's going to believe her anyway," she thought. Deb was a skilled artisan in her own right. So the day Sarah said goodbye, her mother gave her a package and told her not to open it until the next day. Being the obedient daughter she was, Sarah opened the package that night and tried on the one-piece blue cotton coveralls her mother had made for her. The word "Jump Drive Pilot" embroidered on the left and her name on the right. It fit very well, and more than one compliment was given her along with several longing stares once she started wearing it in earnest. By now the rumor had spread about what the company was striving to achieve. The day that Sarah and Rachel arrived back at the harbor caused the anticipation level to peak, to the point where everyone was speculating about what might happen next. "If this thing actually works," people were guessing, "we may be doing this kind of work on Mars before too long." Getting to Mars had been the holy grail for humanity since the days of Apollo. NASA, along with most other countries, were still sending rovers to the Red Planet and to several of the other planets in the system. The early rovers were long dead, but their successes spurred on many more trips with advanced robotics to do as much exploring as possible. Currently, NASA had 4 fully functioning rovers with drones surveying different parts of the rusting globe. To be part of the team to live and work there was such a fantasy, but each of these unknown explorers knew that if John West made it to Mars, they would be on the short list to go there as well. The first day of testing Skiff 10 resembled the first day of testing Skiff 9. No humans, just a couple of concerned chickens whose age were showing by now. Rachel was quick to point out that the chickens should have jump drive pilot suits as well, but Sarah was not around to hear. Of course, the jab would be repeated next time she was. All 3 children burst out laughing at the idea. Day 2 testing was going to involve Skiff 9 and 10 stepping at the same time to the same level, but several kilometers apart to see if any sensations were encountered in this configuration. When the big moment came, Sarah climbed into Skiff 10, John got into Skiff 9, and the 2 crafts moved onto station. As the testing began, Sarah went to step first, then John followed. As Sarah sat there in her very confined space, she quickly reviewed what she was supposed to do. So far, nothing different than how it had been on all previous tests. This would be noted in the log later. For now, her hand reflexively moved over a control panel near her right hand. The index finger found the switch, and without thinking, she pressed it. "Dad," she called out, "y'all good?" "Sarah?" Dropping back into normal space had cut him off short, but the surprise sound in his voice sent a chill through his daughter's cramped body. She cut power. "Dad, are you okay?" she called out. John's reply was immediate. "Yes, I'm fine. You?" "I'm fine. You just sounded concerned or something," Sarah replied. This was the first time the radio had worked in step space. The signal did not get through to normal space in all previous attempts on step, so John wasn't sure what to make of it, but this turn of events seemed promising. The rest of that day was spent testing the engine at this first true step level along a baseline that took the craft from one side of the moon to the other. The drive itself seemed stable, and by the end of the day, the distance covered were in the millions of kilometers. It was soon realized that something was wrong with either the power supply or the drive, but the anticipated second step could not be reached. As the power draw approached the expected point of stability, the craft would shudder, and then the breakers to the fuel cell generator would trip. Regardless, this was a huge leap forward, and Sarah's testing of the craft over the next several weeks pointed out several interesting phenomena. One thing was, even if the step were never achieved, you could bounce, and if the spent mass was getting converted, a reflection took place, just not much of one. The power consumed doing it this way was total waste. But John imagined it might be a quick and dirty way to use the step space, even if it was poorly utilized. Second, there appeared to be no time dilation associated with this form of travel. If the same distance were crossed in normal space over the same amount of time, clocks would have shown the difference. Then there was the radio. It was tested to exhaustion over many days, and since both platforms were available, SCIF-10 could be sent out to a significant distance, and as near as anyone could tell, there was no time lag with the radio signal. John would not let Sarah go out too far, but it was clear there were things happening that were not understood. Mars or bust. Rachel returned from a trip to Earth with the diagram in hand for the next power unit, the sight of which caused John's stomach to churn with discomfort. It was big, half again the size of the skiff itself. This was going to require something else, a completely new ship with a completely revamped step drive, plasma thruster, and everything. It was going to be tens of millions of dollars John's company did not have, and the idea of bringing in additional investors, splitting the company even more, made him feel sick. A large vessel did solve an issue that he had been fighting with. The likely reason the plasmoid could not stay on the second step was the inner structure of the plasmoid the original drive unit created was too big. The layered forces that it was encountering at this next step level was hidden beneath a strong tension that needed to be overcome. Like the counter-rotating Birkeland currents powering the auroras and possibly the sun itself, the next step required surmounting an ever-increasing number of denser bands that needed to be reached to be able to hold the step. The shuddering that Skiff 10 had encountered was the inner portion of the torus buffeting against them, but never completely coming into resonance. It was going to require a larger sheath under higher compression, which meant a larger step drive requiring a larger energy spike and magnetic compression frame to match. Rachel had anticipated something along these lines when she saw the size of the new power plant, so she took measures on her own. Returning to the Weiss Investment Group, she laid out a plan whereby Weiss would have exclusive rights to the Weiss Harbor facility with the intent of developing it for tourism. Weiss would forgo all shares in John's company and pledge an additional $2.5 billion in a promissory note that would be made available in installments over the next 3 years. John's company would retain the rights to all the construction equipment at Weiss Harbor, along with ferrying fees that would be negotiated upon final agreement. Paying customers could begin the trip as soon as the deal was done and the harbor reconfigured for guests. The group jumped at it. So as Rachel filled her father in on the tentative agreement she had made with the Weiss Investment Group, his eyes lit up. They were going to Mars.